beneficiary of takeovers and this and that. And if somebody says you have $25 stock, I'm offering you $45, yeah. I tender my stock.
Of course. Okay. Well, but it was more than that.
It was much more than that.
It gets me pretty vicious. It was pretty vicious battling. And which was it, the book, The Barbarians of the Gate? Yeah. You wrote that. That gives you some idea of the nasty sort of stuff that goes on there. Westinghouse, I only know secondhand, very much secondhand, and that's probably been alluded to by other people.
Yeah. You didn't know any of the parties.
No. They were very peculiar. They never had a medical organization. Because they had one in the late 40s, and this guy was ahead of his time, and that really shook them up, and they never really done anything about it until recently, and they got rid of it again. Mm-hmm. And, leadership there, I'm not terribly impressed with either. Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't know that. It's purely secondhand to you.
Oh, I know what everybody else knows around
here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, I saw the previous chairman acting as chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University. He did a very poor job. Did a lousy job. He was totally incompetent. Mm-hmm. No one was minding the store. And no one still is minding the store. But that's another issue. The University of Pittsburgh, well. Okay.
Would you like to make some more comments on
that? University of Pittsburgh? Mm-hmm. Well, I've lived now in three universities. Michigan, Ohio State, and Pitt. And I must say I've never seen a educational institution totter from crisis to crisis. And they're not even good crisis managers either. And I'm just totally unimpressed with the administration of this university. Certainly the previous president was useless in the last 10 years. Absolutely useless. And the Board of Trustees were equally useless. Well, there is, 38, 39 members of the Board of Trustees. You have to ask who's minding the store. Mm-hmm. And the store goes on. Mm-hmm. And the present chancellor, as he's now called, O'Connor, is really a very big disappointment to the university community. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he exercises very, very poor judgment. His performance in his first few weeks in office at the state legislature was really catastrophic. He did a very poor job of presenting the university's case. As a matter of fact, he did an antagonistic job. Mm-hmm. And the recent Debtree situation here in town, I think, is a perfect case in point of total mismanagement. Mm-hmm. This business of, you want to get into this? Mm-hmm. This business of Debtree being irreplaceable when he's supposed to retire at age 65, 70, whatever, is nonsense. Because the appointment of Rudolph as the vice chancellor for health, finances, or management really was a very studied, what should I say, maneuver to keep Debtree here for very straightforward reasons. Because Debtree reported to the chancellor, now Romoff reports to the chancellor, and they're looking for a replacement for Debtree. But there's an old saying which relates to the golden rule, and that is he who has the gold rules. And if Romoff has the money, how can anybody take Debtree's job without that financial control and have responsibility for the health center? Now, setting that Romoff appointment up before Debtree retired was really, to me, a quite clear case of a setup. No one knows for sure what the sequence of events were, but the three possibilities exist. One possibility is that the Chancellor O'Connor was told that as a part of his agreement to take on this job that he would have to agree to his appointment to Romoff as vice chancellor for financial or health center for the health center for financial affairs. possibility was after he took the job, accepted the job, he was told, by the way, this is the condition of it. If you don't like it, you can resign. But it doesn't look too good. And the other possibility was he was stupid enough to be asked to do it and did it without thinking.
Did they bring a ton of money as a consequence? I mean, where does this money control?
The money control lies, the control lies with Deckard, period.
Yeah, but why?
Because Tom Deckard is Tom Deckard.
He has to be a unique channel or source.
No, he's not a unique channel or source. He's
well, then he, why does he control the money?
Because he controls everything. He's a control freak. What?
I'm looking for the source of that. There's a rich man he owns, or there's a legislative source.
No. The source is the health center. The health center is a cash cow.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, and who controls the health center controls a lot of money. If you figure that there is $500,000 in cash flow involved with each transplant, mm-hmm. and there's 200 transplants per year, mm-hmm. and this is minimum numbers, mm-hmm. just take a look at the numbers in terms of cash flow.
$100 million.
It's $100 million right off there. And it's bigger than the budget of the rest of the university, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he who controls that controls everything. Mm-hmm. And appointing Rudolph essentially, when they looked for candidates to replace Deckard, all four candidates, and I knew two of them, mm-hmm. all four candidates turned it down. Of course, the reason they turned it down was because of this arrangement. How can they take responsibility for the whole health center operations and not have financial control? So you get candidates, you get perfectly qualified candidates, and they all turn it down. Now, this isn't a stupid setup, but it's a very clever, very Machiavellian setup. So the Chancellor declared that Deckard is in effect irreplaceable, and they discharge a search committee, and not even looking anymore. And the excuse is, well, you know, the whole healthcare delivery thing is in a state of flux. Well, it's going to be in a state of flux for the next 20 years. So I think Tom Deckard's going to be in a state of flux running the place for the next 20 years. But it was a perfectly Machiavellian setup that works, has worked to a fairly well. Now, I mean, Deckard has done a lot for this place, no question about that. But he's also been... Oh, what should I say? First of all, the times he's vocal up, the times he's very into it. He has his own vision of where things should be, and obviously not everybody agrees with that vision. Nor the sense of it. But he is totally powerful. And I remember when this business with this scientist and the lead business came out, and we had this inquiry here, that it was reported in the media that in the University Times that when this researcher was asked to cooperate and do work on transplants, which he was not interested in or was concerned, he was advised by them. He said, "I can cut your legs off." And this is a direct quote. And that's the kind of man he is, and he will, and does.
Know where you're staying.
Well, yes and no. But you see, that's the difference between university politics and corporate politics. Corporate politics is the full frontal attack, and you know where you stand. University politics, if you someday feel something's wrong in your back, and you reach back and you find a knife plunge there, there's indeed a knife plunge there, but you never saw who or where or when. Very much liquor politics, much smoother politics, much more just as vicious politics, and it really is a lot of very clever people contesting for very limited resources. So it brings out the absolute worst in people. But that's university politics, but Deckard is a practitioner who did fairly well.
How do you spell Deckard?
D-E-T-R-E.
Did you not find that to be true, though, at Ohio or
not to this extent. The other universities, there was, you know, there's always this continuing struggle between administration and faculty. The administration's winning, obviously, around the country because there's going to be more and more administrators for this, that, and every other thing. But it, was in a reasonable balance at Michigan. And Ohio State had its own problem because they had a state legislature right down the street. The state legislature was always poking their nose in the university business. Anyway, that's the subject, for example, of a play written about Ohio State by Jamie Thurber called The Male Animal. And indeed, that was much the problem there. But that was a specific problem that certain state universities have. Wisconsin has it too, for example, downtown in Madison, the state legislature there, and always poking around. But that's a generic problem of a sort. But most other universities, there were a few exceptions. Boston University, of course, has had a continuing, unbelievably strong president by the name of John Silver, who was one-armed character, who was a tough, tough person.
Washington and State, or St. Louis?
No, Boston.
Boston.
Oh, I'm sorry,
Boston.
I thought you said Washington.
Your remark about Boston. I mean, why would you know a chair on Boston University?
Well, because
Catholic school.
Because in academic circles, we know what's going on. Oh, yeah. Well, this man's a national figure.
Yeah.
And so, but except for those few exceptions, most universities have come to a dynamic equilibrium, you might say. Here, it's been a continuing hassle back and forth, and I must say I find it very disagreeable here. It's not disagreeable, it's just sad. It's a lot of energy, which is wasted, a lot of energy we've done on more profitable things. I think the University of Pittsburgh has a generic problem, and that is that no one manages the administrators. The board of trustees have always been people who are on the board because they get football tickets and are honorific, and you have to wonder who is minding the store. I think this is the problem. You've got too large a board, and the university in the past has been considered to be a nice plaything for the powers that be in town here, and they were on the board of trustees. At times they didn't exercise the oversight that they should have, with example of Posvar, I think, and with Litchfield, and with Chancellor Bowman. You know, this goes on and on and on. So I think the University of Pittsburgh has a generic problem, really, a structural problem. It's a pity. It's impacted upon the School of Public Health here very badly because of Detrey's vision. Detrey has no vision of public health, and so he subverted, as far as I'm concerned, the bequest of the Mellon family, which founded the school, and is turning it into something which has nothing to do with public health. He's turning it into something which is essentially a real estate operation. Mm-hmm. But it's his vision that the future is in at the molecular and research frontier. Now, he's wrong as far as research, because the emphasis now is on healthcare delivery, not research. And that's not where the money is going to be in research, and that's really been the case in the last 5 to 10 years, that the research monies have been flat, going down, and but he keeps on plowing in this approach. And I think he's wrong. And I think it also does a disservice to the community in terms of the university being a teaching institution. As far as he's concerned, you get rid of the students and be a research institution. And that's almost clearly stated. So I don't think he's been very healthy for the university. There's not a proper balance.
Well, isn't it true that basically most places run a balance which runs this way or that way?
Runs a balance, yes. Yeah. And here there's no balance. The attitude is students are a source of income and not a very good source of income, so they're sort of in the way.
I'm so sorry to hear that. I have a son in medical school.
Well, see, the medical school has got the same sort of problem. Detrey will not have a leader, doesn't want leadership, because they'll be contending with him. So the dean of the medical school, the dean of the School of Public Health, the dean of the dental school are just very weak characters, and they're not helping the school at all. Detrey's going to run it, he's going to run everything. And Tom and I have talked about this at times when he said what his specifications were to be for a dean of the School of Public Health. He said, I want a full-time researcher. I said, Tom, how can you have a full-time researcher? Somebody has to make the administrative decisions around here. He says, I make all the decisions around here. And that's literally true. So the dean of the medical school is a very weak character, the dean of the School of Public Health. but useless. He's a loose cannon rolling on the deck. And he's not in public health. And it's really very sad what's happened there. But it's even sadder for the people who have spent their whole life there and given their whole life to that institution. It's really, really regrettable. But I'm an outsider, so I can look at it as somewhat, hopefully, more objectively. Sad to say this, but Wetry has been detrimental.
Yeah. Dr. Denman, again, I'd like to ask you if there is anything that you would have changed in your career, or...
I wouldn't talk about Whistle's mother. I wouldn't have made that proposal, anyway, a modest proposal.
That was Swift's
modest proposal. This being Dr. Denman's solution to pollution. Yeah. Well, no, there is no major difference change. I would have done things differently. Except, well, it's a very minor thing.
Yeah, that's
true. Oh, it's minor. Someone misinformed me in Geneva. I was to make my speech against the convention. And it was supposed to be the argufying speech, and for some reason you do it twice. Someone told me you're supposed to do it in the second speech, so I did it in the second speech. It was too late. If I was going to convince people, I had to be in the first speech. Mm-hmm. I got mousetrapped there. Someone snuffed me up. I don't know what happened. I still don't know this day what happened. Why I was told this. Anyway, no, that's pretty minor sort of thing.
Dr. Denman, can we go back now to family life?
Sure.
And would you like to tell us if you had any involvement at all in the Jewish community or Gabby or your children, if there was tradition in the home or not traditional? Basically, if we could talk a little bit about Jewishness.
Well, it was, you wouldn't say we were a strongly traditional home. On Friday nights, when the children were younger, Bobby would light the set of candles, and I would raise the cup.
Did you?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I did that, and we thought it was a good idea to at least get that much into it. The kids disliked religious school intensely.
Where'd they go?
They went to, they went to we lived in South Hills. Beth Emmett, I guess, at that time. Beth
Emmett?
No.
Beth El?
Beth El. No, Beth El. On Valley Hill Road.
Valley Hill Road.
Beth El?
I think so. It's Beth El.
Are you sure?
No. I'm pretty
there
sure.
There are two
there. Yeah, there are two there.
No, that's right. No, not that one. The other one's a conservative one.
No. Not reform.
Mm-hmm. I think
it's Beth El. Well, I don't know. We also...
But you lived in the South Hills?
We lived in South Hills. Well, we lived in the South Hills from 1973 to 1987.
Is that North Lebanon?
No, we lived in Upper St. Clair. In Ann Arbor, what an interesting situation. There was no official or formed, reformed congregation. So we started one with a group of friends, and some were faculty, some were practitioners around town, some other friends, and we started a temple there. And it was very interesting. We didn't have any place to meet, so we met in this church. And the church was very kind about it. And it was not a Unitarian church, by the way, either. It was a Episcopal church. And they provided space, they were very reasonable. And after a while, the congregation got so large that they still couldn't afford a building. So they worked out a deal with the church, and they bought half the building. And they both used the building. And there was a cross outside and a mounting board outside. It was a very interesting congregation.
It's still there?
It's still there, yeah. And we were the pillars of the temple, because we started from the founder.
When you left, how many members were there?
Oh, there were a fair number of members. There must have been about 60, 70, 80 members by that time. Started out with about 10 members. So we built the temple in the 8 years in Ann Arbor now. but the kids were all young then, and they weren't many.
What was the name of it?
Oh, I have, I can't remember now. I'll have to look back.
Okay.
I'll have to get that one. I forget the name of it. That's why Beth Emma sort of brought me up short, because maybe that was it. I'm confusing that with the one here locally. I can check that telephone.
Okay.
Yeah. But maybe it was Beth Emma up there. I'm not sure.
Beth Emma.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that was, the kids were sort of younger then, and we still had Shabbos candles and wine. And of course, we have the Seder every year. And we still have that every year, but that's a sort of a movable feast in time and space. It's got to meet everybody else's schedules and not quite the religious calendar. So we may have it in Philadelphia, or we may have it in Pittsburgh, or wherever it's convenient for everybody. So that's, of course, but I really have never been active in temple affairs because I've been busy making a living. And these jobs are always more than 8 hours a day, obviously. So I've always worked at home and always worked at nights. But that was sort of required by the job.
Were the children bar mitzvah in Bas Mitzvah?
Yes, they were all bar mitzvah.
And in the South?
Yes. Yes. No, well, let me see. The oldest one was in Ann Arbor. Ann Arbor? That can't be. No, they're all from Southfield. That's right. They're all Southfield.
Dr. Dittman, would you like to comment perhaps on family vacations or how, I know you have talked about your
that
trip.
That trip.
But just in general, like how you would spend maybe the summers, or the family would spend summers, or the children go to camp, or...
Well, the summers, children never went to camp, and we would take short trips, local trips. We didn't really do them because I was working all summer. There was no summer vacation because we had a 12-month-a-year training program, and of course, in Alcoa, we took vacations. We always took vacations with the family, though, in Colorado, and we'd go skiing there on Christmas. And we've been doing that until recently. But
so everybody sort of converges on Colorado?
Everybody converges on Colorado. Well, not now. Last year we had a wedding out there. My daughter's sister-in-law got married. She married somebody in Vail. He was in Vail, so we all went out to Vail last year. But ordinarily, our vacation was a Christmas vacation. The family went on, and we would go to Aspen. We've been going to Aspen for years, and we taught all the kids how to ski from the age of 4 or 5, and they're all superb skiers now. And we still go to Aspen, but we do it with ourselves now because the kids are all either working and can't get away then. Aspen, or our skiing out there in Christmas is very difficult anyway, because it's the most crowded time. So we try to work in things as we can. But we did not ordinarily take family vacations in the summertime.
Which one of your children
were married? The second daughter.
That's the only one?
That's the only one who is. No, well, one was divorced. The older son was divorced.
Did one of the children? Jewish spouse?
Nope, he's Irish, Mahoney. And they live outside of Philadelphia.
Mahoney?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are they being brought up Catholic or Jewish?
Both. No, don't tell me how that works. But both.
I've known several.
I don't know how that works.
Mm-hmm. And are the grandchildren male? Mm-hmm.
Well, there's one of each. There's only two of them, and there's one of each kind. But that's family planning. That's how we go.
They had a pattern to set.
Yeah, they had a pattern. Now, of course, I guess that the next one's going to be a girl. They don't know yet, but they usually get the sonograms.
Do any
moment, yeah. Mm-hmm. So if the pattern files, I guess it'll be a girl.
Mm-hmm.
the oldest son is finally got divorced a few months ago, and he's going now with a very nice Jewish girl, thank God. And she's in Washington, where he is. It's interesting, her mother is the producer of the Washington Week in Review, and she's also producer for National Public Radio. So they'd be some interesting people, too.
Dr. Dimon, can you talk maybe a little bit about the differences in the Jewish community in Philadelphia, well, the community, period, the differences in Pittsburgh as compared to Philadelphia?
Or Ann Arbor.
Or
University
or
Town.
The university.
Yeah, University Town Jewish community is obviously a bit of a different pattern. There are the business people in town, sure, but obviously University Town is a large academic contingent, and it's not predictable as to where the balance is going to be. I don't think it's any different because of this academic contingent. I don't think it's any different between distribution reform, conservative, or orthodox. It's curious that one of the members of the orthodox community in Ann Arbor. He was also a professor at the university, and he was in Hebraics, and he was held to be a very learned man. He was a pompous character, but that's beside the point. I guess he's academia too. And he was very disparaging, of course, of the Reform movement. And lo and behold, he ends up on the faculty down at Hebrew Union College. So I think this guy flew the covers of wherever he was at the moment, anyway. But nevertheless, the distribution in the academic community across all three, and all four Reconstructionists, too, get into the act. There's some of those also, though they weren't very prominent in Ann Arbor. But they were well distributed across the community. But they did make a bit of a difference in the activities of the temples. There was traditional activities of the women's and men's clubs, but they brought a different dimension, I think. So the university towns, the Jewish communities are a little bit different. As you'd expect, obviously. The interests are different. The intellectual interests are different, of course. But the distribution among the Reform, Orthodox, or Conservative is really not much different from general communities. I suppose reflects what you're brought up as, in all probability. I don't know. But it was different. Now, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, I find, are very similar. There are, well, let me see, how should I put this? In the up until the 1930s, people didn't move around much in the United States. This was not the culture. There was a certain amount of movement, of course, obviously, from the 19th century, the movement west. But after the end of the 19th century and up until the 30s, people didn't move around much. And I find that there is one group of people here in Pittsburgh in the Jewish community who have never moved out of Pittsburgh. And I think that's all they'll know. And sometimes I think that's unfortunate. Oh, sure, they travel, everybody travels. But still, I think it leaves a parochial point of view. And I saw this in Philadelphia. And I see even more so when I go back to Philadelphia and see the Jewish community there. And the ones that stayed there are very, very narrow-minded. Very small perspectives and very much less flexible. But I don't think this is peculiar to the Jewish community, I think it's any community. And those who have been around, who have lived in multiple places, and have not stayed in one place, I think have a larger perspective on the world than the ones who stayed in town. I think you see the same thing here in Pittsburgh. And I see it very markedly that going back to Philadelphia, because I can contrast it now with what I would have been if I would stay there versus what I wouldn't have done if I had stayed there. And what I wouldn't have done, I think these things just wouldn't have happened if I would have stayed there. And I think it's the same situation for Pittsburgh, too. It's so easy to get that way. I mean, I remember we lived in the South Hills, people in the Jewish community north. in the North Hills or in Squirrel Hill would never, didn't know where the South Hills were just about. And I remember in Philadelphia, the people in Oak Lane, which is up in the northern suburbs, didn't know anything about Overbrook, which was in the western sort of side of town, near the western suburbs. So there's a certain amount of, I think, people stay put, a certain amount of parochialism that is seen in Jewish communities, and it felt like any other community, I suspect.
Dr. Dinman, I, for one, would like to thank you. You have been extremely interesting and very easy to interview, quite frankly.
You've certainly
added a lot. If there's anything else that you'd like to add before we turn the tape off, again, I have certainly enjoyed it. I know Howard has as well.
Well, it's a little bit different.
It's a little bit different,
I think.
Yeah, it's very, very
But I'm sure others have other stories just as interesting, I'm sure.
You projected very well.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you, yeah, sure thing.